This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Faith of My Fathers by John McCain with Mark Salter. Read for you by John McCain.
A survivor of Auschwitz, Viktor Frankl, wrote movingly of how man controls his own destiny when captive to a great evil. Everything can be taken from man but one thing, the last of human freedoms, to choose one's own attitude in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way. I've spent much of my life choosing my own attitude, often for no better reason than to indulge a conceit. In those instances, my acts of self-determination were mistakes, some of which did no lasting harm and serve now only to embarrass and occasionally amuse the old man who recalls them. Others, I deeply regret. My grandfather was a naval aviator, my father a submariner. They were my first heroes, and earning their respect has been the most lasting ambition of my life. They have been dead many years now, yet I still aspire to live my life according to the terms of their approval. They were not men of spotless virtue, but they were honest, brave, and loyal all their lives. From both my parents, I learned to persevere. But my mother's extraordinary resilience made her the stronger of the two. I acquired some of her resilience and her felicity, and that inheritance made an enormous difference in my life. Our family lived on the move, rooted not in a location, but in the culture of the Navy. I learned from my mother not just to take the constant disruptions in stride, but to welcome them as elements of an interesting life. The United States Naval Academy, an institution I both resented and admired, tried to bend my resilience to a cause greater than self-interest. I resisted its exertions, fearing its effect on my individuality. But as a prisoner of war, I learned that a shared purpose did not claim my identity. On the contrary, it enlarged my sense of myself. First made a migrant by the demands of my father's career, in time I became self-moving, a rover by choice. In such a life, some fine things are left behind and missed, but bad times are left behind as well. You move on, remembering the good, while the bad grows obscure in the distance. I left war behind me and never let the worst of it encumber my progress. This book recounts some of my experiences and commemorates the people who most influenced my choices. What balance I have achieved is a gift from them. I have a picture I prize of my grandfather and father, John Sidney McCain, Sr. and Jr., taken on the bridge of a submarine tender, the USS Proteus, in Tokyo Bay a few hours after the Second World War had ended. They had just finished meeting privately in one of the ship's small staterooms and were about to depart for separate destinations. They would never see each other again. Despite the weariness that lined their faces, you can see they were relieved to be in each other's company again. My grandfather loved his children, and my father admired my grandfather above all others. My mother, to whom my father was devoted, had once asked him if he loved his father more than he loved her. He replied simply, "Yes, I do." On the day of their reunion, my father, a 34-year-old submarine commander, and his crew had just brought a surrendered Japanese submarine into Tokyo Bay. My grandfather, whom Admiral Halsey once referred to as not much more than my right arm, had just relinquished command of Halsey's renowned fast carrier task force and had attended the signing of the surrender aboard the USS Missouri that morning. He can be seen in a famous photograph of the occasion, standing with his head bowed in the first rank of officers observing the ceremony. My grandfather had not wanted to attend, and had requested permission to leave for home immediately upon learning of Japan's intention to capitulate. "I don't give a damn about seeing the surrender," my grandfather told Halsey. "I want to get the hell out of here." To which Halsey replied, "Maybe you do, but you're not going. You were commanding this task force when the war ended, and I'm making sure that history gets it straight." To most observers, my grandfather had been as elated to hear of Japan's decision to surrender as had the next man. Upon hearing the announcement, he ordered the doctor on his flagship to break out the medicinal brandy. He was a jocular man, and his humor could at times be wicked. In the days immediately following the announcement that Emperor Hirohito had agreed to surrender, a few of the Emperor's pilots had either not received or not believed the message. Occasionally, a few Japanese planes would mount attacks on the ships of my grandfather's task force. He directed his fighter pilots to shoot down any approaching enemy planes, but do it in a friendly sort of way, he added. Some of his closest aides sensed that there was something wrong with the old man. His operations officer, Commander John Thatch, a very talented officer whom my grandfather relied on to an extraordinary extent, was concerned about his health. Thatch went to my grandfather's cabin and asked him if he was ill. He recalled my grandfather's answer. "Well, this surrender has come as kind of a shock to all of us. I feel lost. I don't know what to do. I know how to fight, but now I don't know whether I know how to relax or not. I'm in an awful letdown." After the surrender, Halsey reports my grandfather was grateful for having been ordered to join the others on the Missouri. "Thank God you made me stay, Bill. You had better sense than I did." He arrived home 4 days later. My grandmother, Catherine Valks McCain, arranged for a homecoming party the next day attended by neighbors and the families of Navy friends who had yet to return from the war. In the middle of the celebration, my grandfather turned to my grandmother, announced that he felt ill, and then collapsed. A physician attending the party knelt down to feel for the admiral's pulse. Finding none, he looked up at my grandmother and said, "Kate, he's dead." He was 61 years old. He had fought his war and died. Halsey's chief of staff, Admiral Robert Kearney, believed he had suffered an earlier heart attack at sea and had managed to keep it hidden. According to Kearney, the admiral knew his number was up, but he wouldn't lie down and die until he got home. His obituary ran on the front page of the New York Times, as it did in many major metropolitan newspapers. My grandmother received condolences from the nation's most senior military and civilian commanders, including President Truman, General MacArthur, and Admirals Nimitz and Halsey. Navy Secretary Forrestal wrote her that the entire Navy mourned. He was laid to rest in Arlington National Cemetery and awarded a 4th star, posthumously. My father, who had left for the States immediately upon receiving word of the admiral's death, arrived too late to pay his respects. My mother found him standing on the tarmac at San Diego when she returned from Washington. He was in the throes of deep grief, a grief that took years to subside. He told my mother he was relieved to have missed the funeral. "It would have killed me," he explained. There was, however, an event near the end of my grandfather's life that no one discussed. In none of the published accounts of my grandfather's death, nor in any of the many tributes offered by his contemporaries, was mention made of the incident that had cost my grandfather his command just one day before the war's end. Less than 3 months earlier, he had been ordered by Nimitz to resume command of Task Force 38, which at that time constituted almost the entire Third Fleet, as it provided air support to the American invasion of Okinawa. 1 week after he resumed command, my grandfather and Halsey received the first reports from search planes of a tropical storm south of Okinawa that was fast becoming a typhoon. When the first reports of the June typhoon were received, the fleet meteorologists advised Halsey not to move the fleet. But Halsey, fearing that the typhoon would drive him westward and in range of Japanese planes based in China, ordered his task groups to sail southeast in an attempt to get around the storm. My grandfather was aboard his flagship, the Shangri-La. Puzzled by his instructions, he turned to his friend, a war correspondent for the Associated Press, Dick O'Malley, and said, "What the hell is Halsey doing? Trying to intercept another typhoon?" His observation was a reference to Halsey's actions during a typhoon that had struck the fleet in December 1944, sinking 2 destroyers. According to John Thatch, my grandfather had recommended a heading for the fleet that would have avoided the earlier storm, as had Admiral Nimitz. But Halsey had insisted on another course, a course that tragically failed to take his ships out of harm's way. A little less than 6 months later, at 1 o'clock on the morning of June 5th, Halsey received a late report from an amphibious command ship that this latest storm was too far to the south for the fleet to get safely around it. Halsey attempted to get out of its way by reversing course from southeast to northwest, greatly surprising the commanders of his task groups, who were now in imminent peril. At 4 o'clock, one of those commanders, Admiral J.J. Clark, signaled my grandfather, to whom Halsey had given tactical command of the fleet's race to safer waters, that their present course would bring his task group directly into the storm. A few minutes later, he signaled, "I can get clear of the center of the storm quickly by steering 120. Please advise." My grandfather consulted Halsey, who advised against a course change. He then signaled Clark for an updated report of the position and bearing of the storm's eye before ordering Clark to use his best judgment. After communicating with Halsey and Clark, my grandfather could have spent only a few minutes considering the matter before deciding to reject Halsey's advice. But it was a few minutes too long. His order came 20 minutes after Clark signaled for advice, and too late for his task group to escape the worst of the storm. Although none of Clark's ships sank, many of them were damaged, including four carriers. 142 aircraft were lost. 6 men from Clark's task group and a nearby fueling group were swept overboard by the storm-tossed seas and drowned. 4 others were seriously injured. A few days after Task Force 38 resumed operations off Okinawa, my grandfather and Halsey were ordered to appear before a court of inquiry on June 15th. In the court's opinion, the fleet's encounter with the typhoon was directly attributable to Halsey's order to change course and my grandfather's failure to instruct Clark for 20 minutes. Upon receiving the court's report, Secretary Forrestal was prepared to relieve both Halsey and my grandfather. But Admiral King persuaded Forrestal that Halsey's relief would be too great a blow to the Navy's and the country's morale. 2 months later, my grandfather was ordered to relinquish his command. Professional naval officers constitute a small community today. It was a much smaller one in the years when my father and grandfather made their living at sea. Yet I only learned of the episode that closed my grandfather's career when many years later I read an account of the typhoon in E.B. Potter's biography of Admiral Halsey. My father never mentioned it to me. In his memoirs, Admiral Halsey makes brief mention of the typhoon, blaming his task group's encounter with it on late warnings and erroneous predictions of the storm's course. But he offers no description of my grandfather's role in the disaster. My grandfather's request to return home rather than witness the drama of Japan's surrender was a measure of his despair over losing his command. I once suspected, as my father probably had, that the court's findings had hastened my grandfather's death. But as I grew older, it became easier to dismiss my suspicion. My grandfather had not been banished into retirement after losing his command. President Truman had ordered him to Washington to serve under General Omar Bradley as the deputy director of the new Veterans Administration to help integrate back into civilian society the millions of returning American veterans, a prestigious and important appointment. I doubt any assignment would have eased immediately the indignation he must have felt, but by all accounts, my grandfather was tough, willful, resilient. I was a few days shy of my 9th birthday when my grandfather died. I had seen very little of him during the war, and most of those occasions were hurried affairs. The image that remains is that of a rail-thin, gaunt, hawk-faced man whose slight build was disguised by a low-timbered voice and a lively, antic presence. It was fun to be in his company, and particularly so if you were the primary object of his attention, as I remember being when we were together. He rolled his own cigarettes, which he smoked constantly, and his one-handed technique fascinated me. In today's slang, he lived large. He was called Sid by his family and Slu by his fellow officers, for reasons I never learned. He liked to take his shoes off when he worked and walk around the office in his stocking feet. He smoked, swore, drank, and gambled at every opportunity he had. His profile in the 1943 Current Biography described him as one of the Navy's best plain and fancy cussers. My grandmother once informed my grandfather of a new treatment for ulcers she had just read about in a magazine. Pounding his fist on a table, he shouted, "Not one penny of my money for doctors. I'm spending it all on riotous living." My grandmother was reported to have given him an adequate allowance for that purpose while retaining unchallenged control over the rest of the family's finances. My mother, who was enchanted by him, keeps in her living room a large oil portrait of the Admiral, distinguished and starched in his navy whites. In reality, he was a disheveled-looking man with a set of false teeth, so ill-fitting that they made a constant clicking noise when he moved his jaw and caused him to whistle when he spoke. Admiral Halsey and he were such good friends that even in the strain of war, when my grandfather was Halsey's subordinate, theirs was a relaxed and open relationship marked by mutual respect and candor. They delighted in ribbing each other mercilessly and playing practical jokes on each other. When in combat, he dispensed with all Navy regulations governing the attire of a flag officer. Disheveled, stooped, weighing only 140 pounds, and looking many years older than his age, he was nevertheless unmistakably Navy. Sailors who served under him called him behind his back, but affectionately, Popeye the Sailor Man. He wore a ratty, crushed green cap with its frame removed from the crown and an officer's insignia sewn onto the visor. Halsey once described it as unique in naval costume. The cap was a gift from the wife of a naval aviator. My grandfather was much admired by the aviators under his command. Thatch recalled how my grandfather liked to talk to the pilots just after they returned from a strike. My grandfather would give them a cup of coffee and listen intently as his young flyers described the details of their mission, always asking them at the end of the interview, "Do you think we're doing the right thing?" The pilots loved these exchanges, recognizing my grandfather's genuine interest in their views. My grandfather valued the interviews as well. He believed an able commander profited from the insights of the men under his command and should always take care to see that his own decisions were informed by the assessments of those who were charged with executing them. In pictures of him from the war, you sense his irreverent, eccentric individualism. He looked like a cartoonist rendering of an old salt. As a boy and a young man, I found the attitude his image conveyed irresistible. Perhaps not consciously, I spent much of my youth and beyond exaggerating that attitude, too much for my own good and my family's peace of mind. Of more lasting duration and of far greater consequence was the military tradition he bequeathed to my father and me, the tradition he was born to, the latest in a long line of my ancestors who had worn the country's uniform. He was the first McCain to choose the Navy. Until he entered the Academy in 1902, the men of his family had served in the Army. His brother, William Alexander, a cavalry officer who was known in the Army as Wild Bill, was the last. Bill McCain had chased Pancho Villa with Pershing, served as an artillery officer in World War I, and later been a brigadier general in the Quartermaster Corps. He was the last McCain to graduate from West Point. No one in my family is certain if we are descended from an unbroken line of military officers, but one distinguished ancestor served on General Washington's staff. Camp McCain in Grenada, Mississippi, is named for my grandfather's uncle, Major General Henry Pinckney McCain, a West Pointer, and reputedly a stern autocrat who is known as the father of the Selective Service for organizing the draft in World War I. As a boy and young man, I may have pretended not to be affected by the family history, but my studied indifference was a transparent mask to those who knew me well. As it was for my forebears, my family's history was my pride. My father was a member of the Society of the Cincinnati, an association of direct descendants of General Washington's officers. His evident pride in claiming such distinguished ancestry gave me the sense not only that I had a claim on my country's history, but that it would fall to me to represent the family when the history of my generation was recorded. As a teenager, I would occasionally show my closest friends the picture of the surrender ceremony aboard the USS Missouri, and point with pride to the McCain who stood among the conquerors. It is a formidable history, not easily escaped even today by descendants who might wish to pursue some interest outside the family business. My grandfather was born and raised on his father's plantation in Carroll County, Mississippi. The property had been in our family since 1848. My great-grandmother had named the place Waverly after Walter Scott's Waverly novels, but it was always called Teoc, after a Choctaw Indian name for the surrounding area that meant tall pines. I spent some time there as a boy and loved the place. I've been told that the McCains of Teoc were clannish, devoted to one another and to their traditions. By all accounts, they were lively, proud, and happy in their world on the Mississippi Delta. Yet my uncle and grandfather left the comfort of the only world they knew, never to be rooted to one location again. After 2 years at Ole Miss, my grandfather decided to follow his older brother to West Point. At his brother's urging, my grandfather prepared for the exacting entrance exams by taking for practice the Naval Academy exams that were given some weeks earlier. His scores were high enough to earn him an appointment to Annapolis, which, with little reflection, he accepted. He was a popular midshipman, but a less than serious student, graduating in the bottom quarter of his class. That rank, however, exceeded the grasp of his son and grandson, who graduated well beneath it and were lucky to receive their commissions at all. My grandfather's undistinguished record at the academy did not affect his subsequent career in the Navy. Not too long after graduation, my grandfather reported for duty as executive officer to the great Chester Nimitz, then a young ensign. Their mission allowed them to sail virtually wherever they pleased, calling on whatever ports they chose, showing the flag, in essence, to the Filipinos at a time when the United States feared a Japanese challenge for control of the Philippines. Both Nimitz and my grandfather remembered the experience fondly for the rest of their lives. Nimitz once said of it, "Those were great days. We had no radio, no mail, no fresh food. We did a lot of hunting." One of the seamen said one day he couldn't look a duck in the beak again. His tour in Asia ended in late 1908 when he sailed for home on the battleship USS Connecticut, the flagship of Teddy Roosevelt's Great White Fleet, then en route home from its famous world cruise. In the First World War, my grandfather served as an engineering officer on the armored cruiser San Diego, escorting wartime convoys across the Atlantic through schools of German U-boats and learning how to keep his composure in moments of great peril and stress. In 1935, Captain McCain enrolled in flight training, complying with a new Navy regulation that required carrier skippers to learn to fly. Unlike many of his contemporaries, my grandfather genuinely believed that flight instruction would be indispensable to him if he was to command a carrier competently. He would never enjoy the reputation of an accomplished pilot. According to the superintendent of training at the Naval Flight School in Pensacola, Florida, where I would learn to fly 23 years later, in the last 2 weeks of his training, my grandfather cracked up 5 airplanes. He was 52 years old when he earned his wings, among the oldest men ever to become Navy pilots. For 5 months early in the Second World War, my grandfather commanded all land-based aircraft operations in the South Pacific, and he was serving in that capacity during the first 2 months, August through September 1942, of the Battle for Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands. On August 7th, in the first amphibious operation conducted by American forces since the Spanish-American War, the 1st Marine Division landed on Guadalcanal to prevent the Japanese from using a nearly completed airfield for their land-based bombers. Simultaneously, 3,000 Marines landed on nearby Talagi Island to seize its harbor and the Japanese seaplane base there. Despite being harried by Japanese bombers, the landings were astonishingly successful. The Marines, encountering ineffective opposition on the ground, had secured all beachheads on the two islands, as well as the airbase on Guadalcanal, by the evening of August 8th. They renamed the captured base Henderson Field. Whatever relief American commanders may have felt over the initial success of the operation, was soon forgotten in the disaster that occurred 40 hours after the first Marines had waded ashore. Shortly after midnight on August 9th, a task group from the Japanese 8th Fleet surprised the divided Allied naval force protecting the landings. The ensuing Battle of Savo Island, named for a small volcanic island several miles off Guadalcanal, ended in what historian Samuel Elliott Morrison accurately termed the worst defeat ever inflicted on the United States Navy in a fair fight. By the time the Japanese admiral in command of the enemy force called off the attack, his ships had sunk 4 heavy cruisers and 1 destroyer, killing 1,270 men. Fortunately, the Japanese, having gained by their victory command of the sea, failed to land adequate reinforcements on the islands. Thus, the Allied defeat was not a decisive event in the battle for the Solomon Islands. It was, however, a bloody defeat. Worse, the surviving Allied ships that had been forced from the area had not completed offloading the landing forces' food and arms. 16,000 Marines were left stranded, with only half their weapons and supplies, on the densely forested, mountainous island. On August 15th, my grandfather ordered the 1st Marine Corps planes to land at Henderson. Supplies and reinforcements arrived the same day by sea. On August 18th, the Japanese landed a small, inadequate force of 1,000 men. The Marines destroyed them 2 days later. More Japanese reinforcements were underway, arriving almost nightly. By mid-September, 6,000 Japanese were ashore, still not a sufficient number to dislodge the Marines, but battles raged daily throughout most of the month. In the early weeks of the campaign, Japanese planes and ships made up for lack of progress on the ground by pounding Guadalcanal daily with shells and bombs. My grandfather rushed planes, fuel, and ammunition to the island and organized airstrikes against the enemy. Gasoline was in terribly short supply on the island, and extraordinary heroics were performed by the skippers and crews of seaplane tenders, their ships overloaded with drums of fuel, who sailed through exceedingly dangerous waters and under skies thick with enemy planes to carry gasoline to Guadalcanal. He spoke often and gratefully of the courage of the crews that brought gasoline to his dry planes at Henderson. In September, he twice flew to Guadalcanal in a B-17, leading large contingents of fighter planes to Henderson, quote, slipping them in at dusk when the Japs couldn't see us. He stayed ashore under fierce bombing from Japanese aircraft. He later told one of his air commanders that the pilots he met there had resigned themselves to die for their country and had shaken his hand with the attitude of men taking a last farewell. For the rest of the war, the loss of a single pilot would distress him terribly. My grandfather was awarded the Distinguished Service Medal for his leadership during the early days of the Solomon Islands campaign. The citation commended his courageous initiative, judicious foresight, and inspiring devotion to duty. As the chief of the Bureau of Naval Aeronautics, he coordinated the design, procurement, and maintenance of naval aircraft. Coming late to naval aviation made him suspect in the eyes of career aviators who would have preferred one of their own in command. But his success at Guadalcanal convinced Roosevelt and Forrestal that he was the right man for the job. His experiences at Guadalcanal had taught him what the Navy needed in the Pacific. Too few planes and too few men to fly them had forced the pilots under his command to fly constantly, and they'd been reduced to a state of near lifelessness by the strain. When he arrived in Washington, he wanted 2 crews for every plane in the Navy, and he charged ahead, procuring aircraft and personnel at a lightning pace. My grandfather knew how to fight the Japanese, and he outfitted the Navy for the task. An approving Roosevelt appointed him to a newly created post, Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Air. He was the Navy's air boss, responsible for every aspect, human and materiel, of naval aviation, often catching hell from a quarrelsome Halsey for his personnel decisions. He served in that command until the pace of war in the Pacific accelerated as the war in Europe approached its end. In August 1944, he returned to the Pacific to temporarily command Task Group 38.1, one of the fast carrier groups in the Third Fleet's powerful Task Force 38, in preparation for assuming command of the entire task force a few months later. This was the command my grandfather had aspired to above all others, the moment, I suspect, he had waited for all his life. He was a born leader, fit for command, not because of an imposing physical presence, but because he possessed an easy, natural authority with his men. Dick O'Malley, a veteran war correspondent, considered him one of the finest, most effective leaders in the Pacific Theater. Dick was struck by the unaffected qualities that made my grandfather such a gifted commander. Admiral John S. McCain was a very quiet-spoken man, but when he gave an order in his soft, clear voice, there was never any doubt there was command in it. I always remember that Admiral McCain seemed to get his orders carried out more promptly than others, and there was a puzzling feeling that those doing his bidding didn't feel pushed by authority so much as persuaded by reason. He'd been in command of the task group for barely 2 months when the long-awaited campaign to liberate the Philippine Islands began, leading to the largest naval battle of World War II, the Battle of Leyte Gulf. In preparation for the assault, my grandfather's fast carriers launched strikes against Japanese airfields on Formosa on October 12th. Their mission was to destroy the enemy's air power. This they accomplished. Over the next 2 days, 520 Japanese planes were destroyed and considerable damage was inflicted on Japanese installations ashore. The Japanese did manage a counterstrike, fiercely attacking the ships of Task Group 38.1. On October 13th, an enemy torpedo hit the cruiser Canberra, rendering her dead in the water. Rather than sink the wounded cruiser, my grandfather ordered another cruiser, the Wichita, to take her in tow while two destroyers circled them. He then assembled a covering force composed of destroyers and cruisers from three task groups to protect the Canberra as she was towed to port. The next day and night, Japanese planes attacked in large numbers. The cruiser Houston was torpedoed. The Houston skipper believed she was breaking up, and many of her crew jumped overboard. My grandfather told him to abandon ship and ordered several destroyers to help rescue her crew. When he received word that her skipper thought she could be salvaged, he ordered the cruiser Boston to tow the crippled Houston to safety. Admiral Mitcher commanded the task force at the time. He had ordered my grandfather to save the cruisers if he could. In Commander Thatcher's words, quote, "Mitcher took the other task groups and got the hell out of there, leaving McCain with Task Group 38.1 alone to do the job." On the 15th, enemy planes again attacked and one managed to hit the Houston with another torpedo. My grandfather had risked much to salvage the cruisers. It had taken almost 8 hours to get the two ships under tow, and once that was accomplished, the task group had been able to make a top speed of only 2 or 3 knots as it ran a gauntlet of Japanese air attacks. Wave after wave of Japanese planes were determined to make my grandfather's decision to save the ships cost him dearly. Had they succeeded in finishing off either of the two cruisers, or worse, had they sunk any of his other ships, the decision to save the ships would have been regarded as a terribly costly mistake. The author of a book on the fast carrier battles in the Pacific disparaged my grandfather, dismissing him as nothing more than a deputy to Halsey, who was never given tactical command of his task force. Furthermore, the author alleged that my grandfather had relied completely on John Thatch for tactical innovations. My grandfather did give enormous responsibilities to his operations officer and had always taken care to credit Thatch with many of the task force's innovations. When he hired Thatch for the job, having never met him prior to that, Thatch had asked him why he had selected him. "I've heard you're not a yes man," my grandfather answered, "and I don't want any yes man on my staff." Thatch, who admired my grandfather greatly, strongly disputed the author's harsh criticism and insisted that he had command all the time. He was a brave man, and he commanded with courage. Dick O'Malley, who observed him closely in the last strenuous days of his command, said, "There wasn't anything that could put the wind up in him." In a letter Dick wrote to me, he recalled my grandfather's courage under fire. "One day a kamikaze came out of the sun, heading either for us or the Essex, which was close behind. McCain just stood leaning on the rail watching. "They'll get him with those 5 inches," he said calmly. They did. A little over 3 months after my grandfather brought the crippled cruiser safely to port, Admiral Halsey decorated him with the Navy Cross. Had the Enterprise turned out differently, my grandfather might have been relieved of his command. The Battle of Leyte Gulf began on October 23, 1944, when two U.S. submarines patrolling waters off Palawan Island in the southeastern tip of the Philippine archipelago encountered elements of an enormous Japanese battleship force under the command of Vice Admiral Takeo Kurita. Over the next 3 days, 4 separate battles would be fought, pitting a Japanese carrier fleet and 2 battleship forces against elements of the U.S. 3rd and 7th Fleets. When the last battle ended, the Japanese Navy was finished as an effective fighting force for the remainder of the war, but not before the United States Navy had nearly suffered a defeat of catastrophic dimensions. On October 20th, under the overall command of General Douglas MacArthur, the 6th Army, commanded by Lieutenant General Walter Krueger, had staged amphibious landings on the beaches of Leyte Island in the middle of the archipelago, escorted and protected by the 7th Fleet, commanded by Vice Admiral Thomas Kincaid. The operation was hugely successful. By the end of the day, 70,000 to 80,000 troops were ashore. Halsey's 3rd Fleet, under the overall command of Admiral Nimitz, was ordered to cover and support the 7th Fleet. Nimitz had added a clause to Halsey's orders instructing his subordinate to seize an opportunity to destroy a major portion of the Japanese fleet if one arose in the course of the battle, giving Halsey, who had dreamed all his life of commanding an epic battle at sea, leave to fulfill his lifelong ambition. Nimitz's failure to place both U.S. fleets under one naval command inevitably led to poor communications between the 2 fleets. When Halsey perceived an opportunity to take offensive action against the enemy and seized it, the dual command structure nearly resulted in strategic disaster. On October 22nd, Halsey ordered my grandfather's task group, the strongest carrier force in his fleet, to detach from the fleet and sail 660 miles to Ulithi Island to refuel. Even after the 2 American submarines discovered Kurita's force in the Palawan Passage and destroyed 3 of its heavy cruisers, Halsey still saw no reason to order my grandfather to return. It was a decision that both Halsey and my grandfather would soon regret. The Japanese knew that the loss of the Philippines would destroy any hope that Japan could yet prevail against its vastly superior enemy. They devised a desperate gamble to destroy the invading American force, risking virtually all that remained of the Japanese Navy in the attempt. A northern force, with 4 carriers serving as a decoy, was ordered to entice the offensive-minded Halsey into giving chase, leaving the 7th Fleet exposed in Leyte Gulf. Meanwhile, 2 Japanese battleship forces, Kurita's powerful center force and a southern force, sailed for the central Philippines. The southern force would enter south of Leyte through the Surigao Strait. If Halsey fell for the decoy and left his station off the San Bernardino Strait, Kurita's center force would force the unprotected strait from the north, sail down the coast of Samar Island, converge with the southern force, and destroy the unsupported American invasion fleet. On the 23rd, 3rd Fleet aircraft located the center force, and Halsey prepared to do battle. The next day, he recalled my grandfather, but it was too late for him to get within range of the enemy, and Halsey was deprived of 40% of his air strength as he fought what is known as the Battle of the Sibuyan Sea. In Leyte Gulf, Admiral Kincaid was readying his 7th Fleet to do battle with the small Japanese southern force. Lacking the big carriers of the 3rd Fleet, the 7th Fleet had only 18 small, unarmored escort carriers to provide air power with lightly armed planes and poorly trained pilots. Nevertheless, Kincaid knew his fleet, 738 ships in all, was more than a match for the enemy force approaching from the south. The Japanese northern force had gone undetected until 76 of its aircraft attacked one of Halsey's carrier groups late in the Battle of the Sibuyan Sea. Now aware that Japanese carriers were in the area, Halsey's blood was up. He believed that an opportunity to destroy a major portion of the enemy fleet was at hand. He broke off the attack on Kurita's force and ordered all of his carrier groups north to seek and annihilate Azawa's carriers, the decoy force. The decoy had succeeded. Halsey left the 7th Fleet unguarded, vulnerable to and unaware of the threat approaching from the north. Halsey had not even bothered to inform Kincaid that he had left the strait. Before he ordered his forces north, he had signaled Nimitz that he intended to form 3 groups of his fast battleships into a new, powerful surface task force, Task Force 34. Kincaid had intercepted the signal and assumed that the 3 groups were carrier groups that would be left behind to guard the strait. In fact, Halsey's decision to attack the decoy force had preempted the formation of Task Force 34, and all the ships that would have constituted it were now steaming away from the strait. As Kincaid had expected, the 7th Fleet's cruisers, destroyers, and battleships quickly and effectively destroyed the Japanese southern force. But a few minutes after the last shots were fired at dawn on October 25th, Kurita's ships began shelling one of the 7th Fleet's 3 escort carrier groups operating just north of the entrance to Leyte Gulf. This group, known by its radio call sign, Taffy 3, was seriously overmatched by the powerful enemy force now descending upon it. Nevertheless, the unit fought valiantly, losing 1 carrier, 2 destroyers, and 1 destroyer escort in the ensuing Battle of Samar Island. As he raced toward the northern force, Halsey finally formed Task Force 34 and ordered the battleships to steam ahead of the carriers. 3rd Fleet aircraft began attacking the Japanese carriers at 8 o'clock on the morning of the 25th and continued until evening. When the second strike of the day was underway, Halsey received an urgent message from Kincaid informing him that the 7th Fleet's small carriers were under attack off Samar Island by a superior enemy force and pleading for assistance from Halsey's carriers. Halsey ignored the message and continued north. He received several successive messages from Kincaid, the last warning that Kincaid's battleships were running out of ammunition. At 9:30, Halsey signaled back, informing Kincaid that my grandfather's task group was on the way. At 10 o'clock, Halsey received a message from Admiral Nimitz. Where is Task Force 34? The world wonders. The message infuriated Halsey, who interpreted the sentence, "the world wonders," as an insulting rebuke. He threw his cap to the deck after reading it. Clearly, Nimitz was alarmed about the 7th Fleet's precarious situation and wanted Halsey's battleships to defend the battered escort carrier units off Samar Island and prevent the enemy from entering Leyte Gulf. The success of the invasion hung in the balance, but the message to Halsey had been a mistake. The last 3 words had been included as padding to confuse enemy decoders. The signal clerk who received the message before it was handed to Halsey should have deleted them. The irate Halsey considered his response for an hour before signaling Nimitz, "I have sent McCain." My grandfather was already on the way before Halsey recalled him to the battle. He had intercepted Kincaid's messages to Halsey and had made the decision to render whatever assistance he could to the outgunned escort carriers without waiting for orders from the fleet commander. He turned his task group around and raced downwind at a speed of 30 knots toward the battle. At the time, he had 2 squadrons of dive bombers in the air that had not returned from scouting patrols. Carriers have to turn into the wind before aircraft can land on them. In order not to slow down the entire task group while the returning scouts landed, he ordered his carriers to race ahead of the rest of the task group at a top speed of 33 knots. When 6 or more of their planes returned, they approached upwind to begin their landing patterns. The carriers whipped around into the wind and took them aboard. Once the planes landed, the carriers turned sharply downwind again and resumed their 33 knots until the next planes returned and the maneuver was repeated. Thus, the carriers were able to take on their planes without impeding the forward movement of the entire task group, which maintained an overall speed of 30 knots. It was a very difficult maneuver that had never been attempted before, nor since, to the best of my knowledge. It required split-second timing on the part of the carrier skippers and the returning pilots, and steel nerves on the part of the commander who ordered its execution. Halsey had also dispatched his battleships and one of his carrier groups to join the fight. But Halsey's response had come too late to inflict much additional damage on the main Japanese force. My grandfather was now steaming toward the battle, but he was still nearly 350 miles to the east. He went to his cabin for a few minutes to consider the situation and decide what to do. A short time later, at 10:30, he emerged from his cabin, gave the order for his carriers to turn into the wind, and launched his aircraft. He knew that at such a distance from their targets, they would burn all their fuel reaching the battle and would have to land on other carriers or in the Philippines if they didn't run out of fuel while striking the enemy force. It was a daring move, and one of the longest-range carrier strikes of the Pacific War. By the time Task Force 34 and the accompanying carriers arrived off Samar Island, Kurita had broken off his attack and turned north, fearing that he faced a much larger fleet than the greatly outnumbered Taffy 3. At the time of his withdrawal, his ships were within 40 miles of the invasion force. He initially intended to reassemble his disorganized force and resume the attack on Lady Gulf, but the Japanese commander suddenly lost his nerve and made for the San Bernardino Strait. The commander of Taffy 3, Vice Admiral Clifton Sprague, who had commanded his ships with courage and resourcefulness during the fierce attack, credited the battle's abrupt end to divine intervention. John Thatch credited Kurita's unexpected retreat to intelligence the Japanese commander had received that warned him of the approaching strike from my grandfather's planes. Thatch had read an interview Kurita had given after the war. The old admiral explained his decision to withdraw from the battle by recalling information he had received of a large airstrike coming from an unknown location. Kurita's chief of staff gave the same explanation for the force's withdrawal. According to Thatch, until Kurita received the intelligence that precipitated his decision to run, he, quote, thought the whole task force was up there, and he didn't know about McCain. As a matter of fact, neither did Halsey and Mitcher know what McCain was doing at the time. A few days after the Battle of Lady Gulf, my grandfather relieved Admiral Mitcher and assumed command of the entire Task Force 38. He directed its operations until the Philippine Islands were retaken, and then, after a four-month interval, until the war's end. In that command, he directed assaults against Japanese strongholds in Indochina, Formosa, China, and the Japanese home islands. By the war's end, his ships were, quote, steaming boldly within sight of the Japanese mainland. At his death, he was a leading figure in naval aviation, credited with devising some of the most successful innovations in the use of attack carriers. Give me enough fast carriers, he said, and let me run them, and you can have your atom bomb. He was awarded his second Distinguished Service Medal for his gallant command of fast carriers from October 1944 through January 1945. Under my grandfather's command, Task Force 38 was considered the most powerful naval task force ever assembled for combat. Following his death, Secretary Forrestal stated, his conception of the aggressive use of fast carriers as the principal instrument for bringing about the quick reduction of Japanese defensive capabilities was one of the basic forces in the evolution of naval strategy in the Pacific War. 8 years after my grandfather's death, I watched Admiral Halsey deliver the main address at the commissioning of the Navy's newest destroyer, the USS John S. McCain, in Bath, Maine. Halsey was an old man then. As he began to talk about his friend of so many years, his eyes welled up with tears, and he began to sob. Barely a half minute had passed before he announced he was unable to talk anymore and sat down. Plainly, Halsey deeply mourned my grandfather's loss, but the audience sensed that the old admiral was overcome that day by more than sadness at his friend's passing. Many years had passed since my grandfather's death, and surely Halsey had gotten over his grief by then. I suspect that the commissioning had prompted a great tide of memories that overwhelmed the admiral. For Halsey, the memory of my grandfather's friendship conjured up all the grim trials and awful strain of combat, the losses they had endured, and the triumphs they had celebrated together as leading figures in a great war that had changed the world forever. I met Halsey that evening at a reception after the ceremony. He asked me, "Do you drink, boy?" I was 17 years old and had certainly experienced my share of teenage drinking by then. But my mother was standing next to me when the admiral made his inquiry, and I could do nothing but nervously stammer, "Well, no, I don't." Halsey looked at me for a long moment before remarking, "Well, your grandfather drank bourbon and water." Then he told a waiter, "Bring the boy a bourbon and water." I had a bourbon and water, and with his old commander watching, silently toasted the memory of my grandfather. In 1936, while commanding the Naval Air Station in Panama, my grandfather was introduced to me, his first grandson and namesake. My father was stationed in Panama at the same time, serving aboard a submarine as executive officer. He had brought his young, pregnant wife with him. I was born in the Canal Zone at the Cocosolo Air Base Hospital shortly after my grandfather arrived there. My father was transferred to New London, Connecticut, less than 3 months later. My mother has fond memories of the place. Among those memories is an occasion when my parents left me in my grandfather's care while they attended a dinner party. My mother, mindful of my father's concerns about coddling infants, instructed my grandfather to put me to bed in my crib and not to mind any protest I might make. When they returned, they found me sleeping comfortably with my grandfather in his bed. My parents were married in 1933 at Caesar's Bar in Tijuana, Mexico. They had eloped. My mother's parents, Archibald and Myrtle Wright, objected to the match. For months prior to their elopement, my grandmother had forbidden my father to call on my mother, believing him to be associated with a class of men, sailors, whose lifestyles were often an affront to decent people and whose wandering ways denied their wives the comforts of home and family. My mother, Roberta Wright McCain, and her identical twin, Rowena, were the daughters of a successful oil wildcatter who had moved the family from Oklahoma to Los Angeles. Wealthy and a loving father, Archie Wright retired at the age of 40 to devote his life to the raising of his children. The Wrights were very attentive parents, and in their care, my mother grew to be an extroverted and irrepressible woman. My parents met when my father, a young ensign, served on the battleship USS Oklahoma, which was homeported at the time in Long Beach, California. Until my parents' courtship, my mother had, in her words, never teamed up with any man. Their romance progressed for over a year, despite my grandmother's growing anxiety. Until confronted with maternal opposition, my mother, quote, had never planned on marrying anyone. By her own admission, she was a willful, rebellious girl. Her attraction to my father was only strengthened by her mother's disapproval, and when my father proposed marriage, she consented. They eloped on a weekend when my grandmother was in San Francisco. Just before they departed for Tijuana, my mother informed her soft-hearted father of her intention. Despite his misgivings, he didn't stand in her way. The bond between my mother and her parents was a strong one, and in due course, they accepted the marriage and shared with my father the deep affection that distinguished their family. Captain John S. McCain Sr. thought the match to be an excellent one from the start. He was as charmed and amused by his new daughter-in-law as she was by him. Stationed in San Diego at the time of my parents' elopement, my grandfather had traveled to Tijuana with him to attend the ceremony and stand at his son's side. Theirs was also an exceptionally close relationship. The relationship of a sailor and his children is, in large part, a metaphysical one. We see much less of our fathers than do other children. But our fathers, perhaps because of and not in spite of their long absences, can be a huge presence in our lives. You're taught to consider their absence not as a deprivation, but as an honor. By your father's calling, you are born into an exclusive, noble tradition. Its standards require your father to dutifully serve a cause greater than his self-interest, and everyone around you, your mother, other relatives, and the whole Navy world drafts you to the cause as well. When your father is away, the tradition remains and embellishes a paternal image that is powerfully attractive to a small boy, even long after the boy becomes a man. This is the life to which my older sister Sandy, my younger brother Joe, and I were born. It was the life my father was born to as well. And it was the life that adopted my mother, substituting his care for that of a loving and protective family. My father was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa, but he was no more a native of Council Bluffs than I am a native of Panama. My grandmother had gone into labor when visiting family in Council Bluffs while my grandfather was at sea. His boyhood withstood the strain that the Navy imposed on the lives of its officers' families. He would never know any other life. From early childhood, he understood he would share his father's vocation. People who grow up without such expectations might think that anticipating so young the general course of your life would make a child self-assured. And while that condition gave us a kind of confidence, it was often a reckless confidence. We started with small rebellions against the conventions of our heritage. And as we grew older and coarser, our transgressions became more serious. There were times in my youth when I harbored a secret resentment that my life's course seemed so preordained. I often wondered if my father had ever felt the same way. My father was a slight boy, even smaller than his father. He never grew taller than 5'6", and near the end of his life he weighed no more than when he left the Naval Academy, 133 pounds. He was only 16 years old when his father delivered him to the United States Naval Academy for his plebe summer in June of 1927. By his own admission, he was too young for the challenges of such a rigid institution and the highly competitive nature of the place. Shortly before my father entered the Naval Academy, my grandfather, whose ship was being overhauled in the Navy Yard in Bremerton, Washington, invited him to spend 2 weeks aboard ship. They were 2 weeks my father treasured all his life. He referred to them as a, quote, final and farewell gesture before I went into the Naval Academy and began his own life at sea. It is difficult to imagine my grandfather being too concerned with my father's performance at the Naval Academy, considering his own less than commendable record there. My father was constantly in trouble at the Academy. His grades were poor, his discipline worse. By the end of his first term, his grades hovered barely above the lowest acceptable marks, where they would remain for 4 years. The only consistently good marks my father received were for seamanship and flight tactics and ordnance and gunnery. My father was an intelligent man,